Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
All right, a look at investment tonight. Buying real estate has become, for some, almost a national pastime. For those, at least for that generation that had the money to do it, I'm not sure that it's going to be a cross-generational thing. Some of us might actually be better off, though, putting our money elsewhere, perhaps into the share market. We'll talk tonight with Roger Montgomery about why. He's the Chief Investment Officer at Montgomery Investment Management and is well known, of course, to those of us here on Nightlife. And it's a pleasure to welcome him to the studio. Evening, Roger. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you very much, Phil. Nice. Great to be here.
Well, yes, nice to say hello face to face.
Familiar surrounds, but an unfamiliar face.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly right. All right, let's talk about the last quarter. How's it been going?
Well, the interesting thing in the last quarter, obviously, was the Trump election, and everyone got a real head of steam about that. The perspective I'll bring to it is this, that there'll be another election in 4 years, and your investment time horizon, certainly for anyone listening, exceeds the next 4 years. And so what whether Trump was elected and whether he does what he says he's going to do, we don't know. What he says, we don't know, or what he's about to say, we don't know, and we don't know what he's going to do, even if he doesn't say it. So there's so many unknowns that it's very, very hard to make investment decisions on it. And yet, you know, the amount of bandwidth that's been occupied by commentary about Trump and what it means for investing is really, really just commentary on guesswork. People are just guessing. And ultimately, if you buy the right businesses and you pay a reasonable price for them, it won't matter whether Trump was in or Hillary was in. None of those things will matter. And as I said right at the start, there'll be another election in 4 years. So that had a big impact over the last quarter. The other thing that's happened is a little bit more esoteric and takes a bit more time to explain. But what we saw in Australia, and we'll come back to this a little bit later in the program, I hope, but what happened was that the institutional investors in Australia, the very large ones, they found themselves underweight the banks and resource companies at precisely the time that the perspective about their prospects changed and became much more optimistic. And as a result, they sold the things that they owned or had a lot of in order to get back to a market weight or overweight position in those banks and resource companies. And that meant some very, very high quality, high growth companies found their share prices down between 25 and 45% in the space of 60 days. Now, without anyone noticing, we've had a crash in the Australian stock market, certainly at the high quality end. And so that's going to present some opportunities, particularly when we compare the return prospects for those businesses to the asset classes that other investors have been really getting excited about and arguably shouldn't be. So that defines, I think, the last 90 days in the stock market. But really what I want to talk about tonight is, you know, where the returns are going to come from over the next 2, 3, 4 years. And one of the things that you mentioned, or one of the asset classes, Phil, that you mentioned in your introduction was property. And I know that there's a great difference of views about property in Australia, and people think that it will affect apartments and it won't affect houses, or it'll affect large developments but not small developments and so on. What I want to do is cut through all the noise, offer some statistics, and explain how I think those statistics will work their way through to impact prices and possibly impact developers and even banks. And we'll talk about how the banks might be affected by it. So what we've seen, let me paint a picture for you. In the last 12 months, in the 12 months to May this year, the total number of apartments in Australia that were sold, so this is off the plan new apartments as well as existing established apartments, the total number sold in Australia was something in the order of about 96,000. It was actually 96,195 apartments. In the 12, so that's how many. That's the total pool that traded. If you then look at the total number of off-the-plan apartments due to settle in the 12 months to May 2017, that's about 93,000. So almost as many apartments as were sold in total in Australia, in Australia's major capital cities, to May 16, that number again is just off the plan due to settle. And what we know, so that just means there's a lot. But what we know.
So you're saying as many apartments are due to settle by May next year as settled in the previous year?
Not settled, total number sold. Total that's number new sold. And old. So okay. Just new apartments off the plan due to settle is as much as the total number of apartments sold in Australia in major capital cities in the previous 12 months.
Okay.
So that just means there's a lot.
Yes.
And then you have to ask yourself, okay, are there any risks to that settlement story? Because if there are risks, then that means that presumably the developers are going to have stock that they can't sell. And we already know in the background there's a large number of new apartments being developed. In fact, it's a historic
high. They're building everywhere.
Correct. And the number is extraordinary. We've got something like 2 to 2.5 years of natural demand being built just in the next 18 months, being completed just in the next 18 months.
Yeah, we do.
So there's a lot.
So it's not just Sydney and Melbourne. It's Canberra, no. Brisbane.
And we'll talk about ostriches putting their heads in the sand in just a minute because...
Can we talk... Just because we're given two contradictory stories here, aren't we? I mean, because housing people also tell us that there is and has been for some considerable time and that this is a driver of house prices and... perhaps apartment prices. I understand apartments are different. But we've been told for some considerable time that there is a housing shortage.
That's not true.
And that is driving up the cost of housing. No, well...
Well, I can paint the picture. I can give you the stats from the ADS.
State and federal politicians say this all the time.
Yes. Well, that's in their interest.
What, you're saying it's a flat-out lie?
Well, John Howard once told investors to buy shares in T2, Telstra's second tranche, at $7.40, and he said every Australian should own a piece of this great Australian business. And people who bought at that share price have never seen that price again. So you know, I would be reluctant to take investment advice from a politician.
Well, the law of supply and demand must...
Surely
must tell us, though, that if the price of something's going up as much as real estate has...
Yes.
Then there's got to be some connection with the supply of that commodity.
Not necessarily. What you often find in all commodities all around the world, that their price can get way ahead of supply and demand dynamics simply in anticipation of those things occurring. Mm. So they might not actually be occurring. But let's look at some hard numbers. Mm-hmm. So in Australia, the proxy for demand for housing is what we call household formation. Mm. And household formation is growing at about 1.6% per annum, which equates at the moment to about 150,000 dwellings.
What's household formation mean?
So household formation is
people who want to leave home and go and live somewhere else.
Someone who leaves home wants to live somewhere else. Migration is taken into account. A couple who divorce and they split and then there's two dwellings required instead of one dwelling.
So people looking for somewhere to live, in short.
Yeah, and so the estimate is, and it's reasonably accurate, it's about 150,000 at the moment. It's growing at about 1.6% per annum each year. The interesting thing is that the total number of dwellings being supplied at the moment is running at an annual rate of about 230,000 to 240,000 a year, and that's already been happening for about a year and a half. It's going to continue for another 3 years. So by the end of that period, we end up with quite a significant oversupply, which ultimately will be soaked up. But here's the problem. When you combine rapid house price appreciation with burgeoning debt or a debt binge, then you set yourself up for a problem. Now, let me just paint the picture for apartments because I think that's where the problem is. That's the germ of the problem. So of those, you might remember the 93,000 apartments due to settle between now and May, we know that some of those have been...
You mean now? I mean, you mean Tuesday, December the 6th?
Correct. Yeah. Between now and May, we know that a proportion of those apartments aren't going to settle because a proportion of those apartments have been bought by Chinese nationals, for example. And where they've been bought by Chinese nationals, what's actually happened is 2 years ago when that development was sold off the plan, the Chinese national could get their deposit out of the country and that was no problem. Mm. And they assumed that they'd then be able to get the rest of the money out of the country and be able to settle that particular apartment purchase. The problem is that between then and now, the Chinese government has cracked down on the outflow of funds and the transfer of funds overseas, and they've limited it to about $50,000 per person per year. So they now can't get the money that they wanted to get to settle those apartments. So then they turned to Australian banks to borrow the money. And you would know this from reading the headlines, the banks aren't lending now to foreign nationals, not at all. And that's because there's been a lot of fraud and a lot of fakery going on in the applications for those loans from foreign nationals. And so the banks have said, no, we're not lending. So that means some proportion of those foreign purchasers who are due to settle those apartments will fail. We don't know. I don't know what proportion that's going to be, but it will be some proportion. So let's just say that the developers who are relying on the settlement of the apartments that they've settled, that they've sold in order to pay the banks back the borrowings that they took out in order to build the development. And by the way, they're capitalizing the interest on these loans. So they're not paying any interest. That's being capitalized. So the amount that they owe the banks increases.
So they're going to take a big haircut.
Well, will they? Or
That's the life of a developer.
Well, that's just the foreign part. Now, the foreign purchaser part. Now, we also know that local investors, and I use investor loosely, have purchased apartments as well off the plan. Now, what they're finding is that the LVRs are being reduced before settlement. So the banks are saying you need a bigger deposit before you can actually borrow the money from us to buy this apartment now. And by the way, we're going to lower the price. We're going to lower our valuation on that apartment. So the proportion that the deposit represents is much bigger. Mm-hmm. And guess what? Some people will find that they won't settle simply because they look at their equity position and the property price has fallen. They say, well, I've got a negative equity position. I don't want to settle. Or more likely, they don't have the money to increase the deposit that they're required to make that settlement. And so they will default. Now, there's going to be some legal challenges. The developers will sue and they'll insist on settlement, but some people simply won't have the money. And so there's...
And that happens, doesn't it? I mean,
of course it does. Happens all the time.
So people just do their deposit.
But we're going to see, they're going to do their deposit, and we're going to see a lot more of this, and it'll make the news and it'll hit the headlines, and we'll hear these stories more and more. And now remember, so all I'm saying at the moment is some proportion that isn't insignificant of some developments will default. And that means that the developers need to be able to resell those apartments. But reselling the apartments is going to be a lot harder because there's a lot more supply coming on.
So what are they going to do?
So buyers can be picky and choosy. So I think what they'll do...
The developers have to sell.
Remember, some developers started construction when they'd only sold 60 or 70% of the apartments. So there's a whole bunch of apartments to come to market that weren't pre-sold as well. So what they're going to have to do is they're going to have to discount. They're going to have to lower the price of the apartment. And guess what? We're already seeing this happening.
Really?
So, for example, there's a development down in Donvale where the developer in Melbourne, where the developer is offering a 10-year rental guarantee in order to lure buyers. Now, I wouldn't trust a 10-year rental guarantee from a $1 company, but...
How can the developer stand behind that?
Indeed. Yeah. And we'll come back to rents in just a minute and what's happening in the rental market. So they're already discounting there. There's another developer here in Sydney that's offering millions of frequent flyer points if you buy an apartment. And then there are Brisbane-based apartment developers who are offering flights to Bangkok and Bali and Thailand and so on, and Malaysia, if you buy an apartment. So I remember back in the 90s, in the early 90s, when there were developers in Melbourne offering free cars in the garage if you bought an apartment. So what they're doing is they're trying to preserve the asking price or the ticket price of the apartment, but really what they're doing is discounting. Now, the discounting becomes more aggressive when supply starts to increase and other developers also start discounting and compete for the sale.
Can I make this point about property? Property is not a very liquid investment, as we know. It's not like shares or commodities. It's not a truly liquid investment in the sense
illiquid.
It's extremely illiquid because if people don't think they're going to get the price they want, then they don't put it on the market. So
that's
the market,
right.
the market, the market supply is governed entirely by people's expectations of what price they might get. So therefore, this does tend to moderate big falls in the property market because people simply don't put their apartment up for sale anymore.
That's true, but we're just
paying anymore because they think, well, I'm not going to get a good price for it,
so I don't sell it at that price.
So I won't move. I won't downsize.
Yeah.
I won't move to the Gold Coast just yet. I'll wait.
But you don't need everybody to sell for the market price to be lower. And I've just painted a picture where it's the developers that are discounting.
So they're going to take a big haircut.
Well, it's the developers who need to pay back the banks. And in order to get the money to pay back the banks, they need to move all their inventory. How do they move the inventory? Well, the quickest way is to lower the price. And guess what? That lowers the price for everyone. So all we're talking about is one scenario where the developers are in control of the price and they lower the price. Next, we'll talk about the rental market and what's going on there.
Okay, so you say that the banks are not willing to lend to overseas investors.
Because correct.
That's been another way out for developers, hasn't it, to try and market these properties.
Indeed.
Overseas.
Yeah, and that's right. And they're now finding that those buyers aren't able to not able to complete their purchase, or some proportion won't be able to complete their purchases. Another thing that we're seeing in Melbourne, just an anecdote, just a data point.
Sure.
It's really interesting. Real estate agents typically ask developers to pay 50% of their commission up front for selling a particular development, and then 50% when the development's completed. We're now hearing stories where real estate agents are asking for 100% of their commission to be put into a trust up front before they'll even start selling a particular development, because I think they know that there's a problem. But let's turn our attention just briefly to the rental market. And this is typical of what's happening all across the eastern seaboard. But Brisbane, in the first 9 months of 2016, in the 5 kilometre ring around the CBD, there were 5,200 new apartments completed. Now, owners of apartments beyond 5 kilometres in the 5 to 15 kilometre ring have just experienced in the first 9 months of this year an increase in vacancy rates from 2.3% to 4.7%. So they've had a more than doubling of the vacancy rate, because what's happened...
This is where? In Brisbane?
In Brisbane. Mm-hmm. And so what's happened is renters or tenants have said, you know what, I can move closer to my place of work in the CBD. I can move closer in and get a cheaper apartment, so I'm going to leave. And so now there's higher vacancy rates further out. So an investor who has a property without a tenant earns a yield of zero. And if they've borrowed money and they've extended themselves to borrow money, and remember we've got record mortgage debt in Australia compared to incomes and GDP, and record credit card debt, so then you get financial stress. Now, if you think that vacancy trend, that increase in vacancies is going to change, bear in mind that in the first 9 months there was just 5,200 new apartments in that inner ring. In the next 18 months, the number of new apartments completed will rise by another 13,000. So almost a tripling of what we've always already seen again on top of that. So vacancy rates for tenants are going to go up. Rents will have to drop for existing landlords who find a tenant. And I think there'll be a larger number of landlords who won't get tenants for some time. And that means financial stress starts to go up and there'll be people desperate to sell. So I've painted a scenario where we've got pressure from developers needing to sell their apartments, and now we're going to have some pressure from landlords, from investors who are going to now sell apartments. And the response by the banks arguably increases the probability of that happening, because they've just blacklisted lending in particular suburbs. They've just said, these are the suburbs where we're not willing to lend.
Really? Like where?
Oh, well, I don't know the individual suburbs, but if you can Google the AFR article on it, and they actually listed all the suburbs that, I think it was the ANZ and Westpac, are saying we're just not willing to lend to these particular suburbs. So
what areas like Green Square in Sydney,
well,
for example?
Well, presumably Zetland's up there. I don't
Zetland's
know.
Up but, there or South Yarra in Melbourne? Or
wherever, yeah, and South Bank and so on. Wherever there might be an explosion of development.
Anybody's been to Melbourne and seen the cranes
on
the apartment building
it's
going
absolutely extraordinary.
On the south side of the Yarra.
Now, I've been...
knows that it's huge. Or if you've been to Sydney and in and around Zetland and Green Square, you know how many apartments are being built there. For that matter, you know, I've just recently come out of Canberra. I've been you know,
Canberra's an interesting. Canberra's interesting.
There's a massive number of apartments being built in Canberra.
Yeah, so we have something we watch called the Crane Index, and it's the number of cranes or the proportion of cranes that are devoted to residential versus industrial and commercial construction, and it's never been higher in Australia, the number of cranes devoted to residential construction. In fact, I read one story that said that there are more cranes employed in residential high-rise developments in Australia than the entire east coast of the United States. So,
hang on, say that again.
So the number of cranes currently employed, east coast of the United States, not the entire United States.
Yeah, but hang on, the east coast of the United States
includes New York and Florida. You bet.
Massive. That's where most of the people in the United States live.
Correct. So quite remarkable statistics. So some of these things that I've talked about, people really – look, I've been around long enough to know that you can't have record prices and record supply in any commodity coexisting for very long. That's precisely what we have today in residential real estate. We've got record supply and record prices. So one of those two things has to go down. Either supply has to fall dramatically and very quickly, or prices are going to come down. Mm. So I worry or fear for residential investors who have borrowed a lot of money to invest in apartments in Australia. That's my primary concern. And look, a basic rule of investing is this: the higher the price you pay, the lower your return. And low interest rates in Australia and low interest rates right around the world have caused investors to move their money out of term deposits and chase higher returns elsewhere. And a lot of them have gone into property. But we've seen all around the world record prices in everything from real estate to art to wine to low-digit collectible number plates. You know, there's record prices being achieved for everything, and it's a function of these record low interest rates. Interest rates around the world have been declining. In the United States, for example, in July this year, 10-year Treasury bond rates hit 1.36%, which is the lowest they've ever been since the late 1700s, and that's when Captain Cook crossed the Antarctic Circle.
And he wouldn't have bought an apartment.
No.
All right. Yes, it's welcome back to all the states joining us too, by the way, after the cricket. Philip Clark with you on Nightlife, and a very good evening to you. And love you to join this conversation, 1-300-800-222, text on 0467-922-702. Well, I'm talking with Roger Montgomery. He's Chief Investment Officer at Montgomery Investment Management. We're talking about the current investment state in Australia. Particularly, we've been talking about real estate investment, and in particular, the apartment market. Roger, fair to say, is pretty bearish on where apartment investment is headed in Australia, particularly in the major cities of Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, Canberra, and perhaps elsewhere too. Now, I think his general view would be that the oversupply of apartments, the huge number of apartments coming on the market from developers that need to settle by May next year, is going to mean a shakeout in the price of apartments, and subsequently, of course, the rental market in apartments too, for investors who are already in those apartment investments. So, Roger, back to you. I mean, is that probably a fair summary of what you're saying? So,
but bearing in mind that it's the developers, one scenario that I've painted is that the developers will be forced to discount the prices of their apartments that they've completed because they'll need to pay the banks back, and there's such an oversupply that the demand disappears.
Put a number on it. I mean, what do you think? I mean, do you think that apartment prices will fall by what, 10%, 15%?
No, easily more than that.
What,
easily 50, more than that.
40%?
15%, 25%. I think the aggregate number might be in the order of 20%, but in individual developments, there'll be individual properties that fall by 50%. Mm. You know, you'll be able to pick up a bargain over the next 4 or 5 years.
Can I put this to you? It was put to me recently that with a lot of these apartment developments, particularly the new ones, and the advice was I wouldn't be buying a new one at all at the moment because I don't know what the market is for that. I know what the owner paid for it,
yes,
but I don't actually know what the market is for that apartment because it's not until I get a second sale that I actually know what the market is. So in other words, there's no point in the owner saying to me, well, I bought it for $1.5
million. That's the market.
That's not the market.
No,
that's
it's
just
not
what you bought it off the developer for.
Yeah,
so what do you think is what is the strategy for people who are either holding apartments or thinking of buying
if you're thinking of buying one, look, I'm not giving advice, but you know, go and talk to somebody who knows your financial circumstances personally. But I've advised my very closest friends who have leverage to buy a couple of properties to sell them. And that's because they've leveraged. If they'd paid cash and they were willing to hold them for 20 years, you know, then it probably wouldn't matter. But where leverage is involved, then there's financial stress, particularly if you're reliant on income from those properties to help you pay off that debt. And remember, we're talking about a current scenario where interest rates are at record lows, and they may not stay at record lows, which will increase the burden on those landlords even more. And that's my concern for my friends, and which is why I asked them or suggested to them that they should sell.
Well, that's a general question too, which probably we should talk about, which is interest rates. Everyone assumes that interest rates at the current levels are here forever, which of course they're not.
Yeah, well, they call it the new normal, which by the way is just a new way of saying this time is different, and it never is.
The first house, people are tired of hearing this, you know, the first home loan I ever negotiated with a bank was at nearly 17%.
Yeah, that was, it would have been the mid-80s, about 1984 or thereabouts.
That's right.
Yeah, so...
They do go up.
And look, and I just started to paint a picture before we brought everyone in from the other states. You know, I painted a picture where interest rates, United States 10-year Treasury bonds at 1.36% in July this year were lower than at any time since Captain Cook crossed the Antarctic Circle. We're talking about the late 1700s. Rates were, in July, were even lower than during the Great Depression. And in the Great Depression in the United States, we had 25% unemployment. And we've got nothing like that now in the United States, which tells me that those rates aren't justified on economic grounds and so therefore are unsustainable. There's a famous economist, Herb Stain, who once said, if something cannot go on forever, it must stop. And, you know, I think that's a good thing to remember. And this is a great monetary experiment.
People have been predicting this housing bubble collapse in Australia for a very long time.
Well, that means they've been wrong so far.
And it hasn't happened.
Well, I haven't been calling it for a very long time. I'm calling it now.
But what sort of bubble are you talking about? You're talking about a bubble in apartments. What about a bubble in houses?
Well, that's the interesting thing. So that's the question I'm asked the most. How much will it affect detached houses? You know, the simple answer is you drop a pebble in the middle of a pond and the ripples eventually affect everything in that pond. The extent to which the ripples will affect detached houses depends on the extent to which people are willing to swap living in a house for living in an apartment. So you imagine there's a family, they're looking for a 3-bedroom dwelling, and they can go to an auction where the house price hasn't dropped, or they can go and buy a 3-bedroom apartment where the developer's willing to discount by 15 or 20%. To what extent will people not go to the auction for the house? To what extent will the auction audience decline because people are willing to say, you know what, I'm happy to raise my family in an apartment? Or, you know, that's the question that I can't answer, but that will determine the extent to which it has an effect on detached houses.
All right, the number's 1-300-800-222. There are some spots on the board if you want to grab one. 1-300-800-222. Text on 0467922702. I'm with Roger Montgomery. He's Chief Investment Officer at Montgomery Investment Management. We're talking investment strategies, in particular real estate, apartments and houses, and we've been talking about low interest rates too, and the fact that, well, America we're now seeing in a rising interest rate cycle.
Australia's done it as well, thinking
that we are probably not at the bottom yet, but we will be soon, and then we'll also be in a rising.
Well, see, I think this is the mistake a lot of investors make. They listen to the news about the Reserve Bank of Australia's announcements, but not realise that it's not actually the short-term interest rate that they should care about when they're an investor, but the long-term interest rate. It's the bond rate that matters. And the bond rate in Australia has already risen almost 1% just in the last few months, as it has in the United States. So it's already going up. And you've got to remember, we're talking about the greatest monetary experiment in the history of the world. So what happened was we had the global financial crisis, and in order to try and stimulate the economies out of the global financial crisis and avoid a depression, interest rates were cut to zero in the United States. But they found that that didn't work. So what they started to do is they thought, okay, we need to get the long bond rate, we need to get that 10-year rate and that 30-year rate down. How are we going to do that? We'll just buy up all the bonds. So central banks all around the world decided we're just going to concertedly buy all the bonds, and that will drive the price of the bond up, and that conversely, because of the inverse relationship between bonds and interest rates, that will drive interest rates on bonds down. And the idea was that by making the yield curve flat, by making long bond rates as low as cash rates, you make that yield curve flat, then that will drive investment and it will drive spending. Because what will happen is asset prices will go up.
Yep.
Because there's obviously an inverse relationship between interest rates and asset prices. If interest rates go down, the price of money is cheaper. People borrow money to go and invest in assets. And so the asset prices go up, everyone will feel wealthier and they'll go and spend money. Stock market goes up, property prices go up, they go and spend money. Guess what? Property prices and stock markets did go up, but no one went and spent any money.
No, they didn't. Lawrence has got a question probably on a lot of people's minds based on what you're saying. Lawrence, sure. Good evening.
G'day, how are you going?
Well, thank you.
G'day, Lawrence.
So I'm looking at purchasing my first property. Me and my wife have saved up enough now, probably for about 20% deposit around yep. that mark. I'm not yet 30 and my wife isn't as well. So my question is, or it's more of a statement, is I'm concerned that if I get into the market now, that the bubble will burst. Or if I leave it till too late, the market's going to keep rising. People are going to keep on leveraging off of their existing home loans, their existing property, and the property market's going to go up. So really, I'm thinking I've got a no-win situation for myself. Maybe you can be a little bit more optimistic.
So, I have no doubt that there is a bunch of people who are listening tonight.
A lot of people are feeling exactly
that,
like you, Lawrence.
Yeah. They're in exactly that position. So here's the question. If interest rates on your mortgage rose to, let's say, 8% or 9%, just imagine that.
Yeah.
And then just assume that the market value for a period of time, not forever, but for a period of time, declined by 25 or 30%. If you don't care about those two things, then it doesn't really matter. Go ahead and buy, you know, whatever you want. But if that matters to you, then you've got some serious thinking to do. And I can't tell you what to do. But I personally don't know all of your financial circumstances, and I'm not in a position. So I'm not in a position to be able to give you advice.
But I wouldn't be buying today.
You know, I wouldn't be buying today. And my view is, if an investment doesn't make sense because it's offering a low, I look at the income that an investment will produce. That's and when right, I see apartments, you know, apartments, if I have to pay a price today for an apartment, I'm going to get a 2% yield. And, you know, that to me doesn't justify the risk of that asset class. So it just doesn't make sense. But you're not buying as an investment. You're buying to live. You need to have a roof over your head. You know, look, happy wife, happy life. I understand all that. And I understand if you're going to have kids, you need a place of security. But just remember, it's only going to be secure if you're under no financial strain, if interest rates go up and the price of the value of the property drops. So as long as those two things don't matter to you and you can accommodate that extra interest rate payment, you know, then you're going to be fine.
Are you after an apartment or a house, Lawrence?
No, I'm probably looking at land. And for the
sort of house and land package.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So the other thing that was on our mind, we were looking just before the before Trump came in, is yet to come in, I suppose. But the Trump effect as well. So there's a few uncertainties in my mind, and I agree, probably a few more what-if scenarios regarding rate rises versus value percentage drops.
One of the things that you can do, and it might be still a little bit early to do it now in the cycle, but one of the techniques that works, you know, when there's a bit more pressure around, is to actually just throw a silly bid at a property that you like. You know, you just say to yourself, I've got a bit of time up my sleeve.
That's right.
You know, I'm going to offer 10% less, or I'm going to offer 15% less, or whatever, and you just see if anyone bites.
If a developer's under any stress.
Exactly.
They might take the bait.
And you might surprise yourself. You know, you might get something a bit cheaper than what's being listed out there. So anyway, just some thoughts for
Fingers crossed. Yeah, thanks.
On you, Lawrence. I think that's a question that a lot of people have got some queries about too. Michael, hello.
Yes, hi there. How are you?
Well, thank you.
G'day, Michael.
Yes, you'd be familiar with Henry George, no doubt. And Henry George said that property must overwhelmingly be a projection of productivity, not speculation. Mm. Unfortunately, we've found the reverse. And the other factor is that China, choking off the money coming out of that country,
correct,
must be having an adverse effect on it.
It will. And John, you know, it's interesting. John Kenneth Galbraith in 1954 wrote a book called The Great Crash, and he said when all aspects of property ownership are ignored, for example, enjoyment of its use, its long-run worth and the income from that property, and instead is replaced by the hope that the price will go up next month or next week like it did last week or last month, then you have the makings of a bubble. And the extent to the toxicity of the subsequent bust is determined by the level of debt. And in Australia, we've got, as I said earlier, we've got record mortgage debt. And that could put, you know, those two things combined could pose a big problem.
Mm. Okay. All right, Michael.
Thanks for your call, Michael.
Thank you. Sarah's got an issue, which is right in the zone where we've been talking. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Sarah. You're in Melbourne.
Yes, I'm in Melbourne. I have a terrace house in Albert Park.
Yep, that's south of the area.
Well, it's very, it's the top selling bracket.
Mm. Yeah, you've got CBD. A beautiful suburb, and a terrace house is a beautiful property to own in a great suburb.
Lovely.
Yeah. I've had an offer from someone off the street saying they'd pay 1.5. I wonder, downsize and get some equity. I'm just at the age, and I was looking at, well, it's an apartment, it's in a big block, well maintained in Brighton, and but I'm suspicious because the agent is saying he wants, the owner lives in London, she wants to sell before auction if someone offers $730,000. It's been on display, but nobody's offered anything.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go.
Yeah. So,
and I'm just wondering why, you know.
Well, first thing, never ask a barber whether you need a haircut, right? So you don't take your advice on whether you should buy something from the person selling it. You know, it's really important to be very patient in these things. But it does sound as though you're in a very strong position to negotiate a good deal, because I think the number of apartments is increasing. Remember, there's a lot of maintenance involved, particularly if there's a lift in the building. You know, the costs generally over time keep climbing, precisely at the time where your income is probably flattening out. And so you just got to keep that in mind when you're switching from a house to an apartment block.
Can I ask one question here, Roger, which might be of help to you too, Sarah? We've been talking about the precarious nature of new apartments.
Yes.
I mean, existing apartments are in a market, and we know what the market price of those are. And
but
Sarah,
they're also
this one that you're, of yours, Sarah, is not a new apartment, is it?
No.
No.
It's an established apartment.
Sort of slightly deco-ish, but well-maintenanced.
Well, it just comes back to the same situation. I mean, you're not trying to trade these things and pick the bottom and the top. Mm. It's a change of lifestyle for you. We do have record prices for residential real estate in Australia at the moment, so arguably it's a reasonable time to be selling. I'm not predicting what the price of your house in Albert Park's going to do next, but you know, that's a good time to be selling. Whether or not it's a good time to be buying that particular apartment, whether that the price is reasonable for that particular apartment, I don't know. But presumably, it's also influenced by the fact that we've got low interest rates, and so the price is relatively high. And that vendor also realises that they're getting a good price at this time of the cycle.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Sarah. In general, you've got a lot of choice, haven't you?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. I think so.
John's probably got a question too, which people who own apartments want answered. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you.
Oh, well, I bought an apartment, say, 9 years ago in West End, Brisbane.
Mm-hmm.
From a developer, probably paid a little bit too much in hindsight, right?
Yep.
But paid the 20% deposit and now been paying principal and interest for the 9 years, etc. But do you sell that? Given, you know, I can't afford it at this stage, you know, in terms of even if interest rates go to 5-6% and rents drop, which they have been dropping, I still can afford it.
So when you make that assessment, you've got to ask yourself, what's the worst case scenario for the income from the property, and yep, what's the worst case scenario for my costs associated with maintaining that property and any mortgage attached to it? And then what you do is you run through some scenarios and you say, okay, well, what if I didn't get a tenant for 6 months? What if interest rates rose? Am I still as comfortable as I am today? And if you're not, then perhaps you've adopted more risk than you're willing to actually stomach.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, if you say you're willing to sort of drop your rent, you know, even like I did for this, you know, just dropped it a bit below, below say, $20 before what everyone else is asking.
Yeah.
In order to get that.
And you got a tenant as a result of doing that?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And if interest rates did rise, then you're still going to be okay? The rent's still covering that? You're probably, presumably you're working, so you've got other income, so you can service that mortgage, and you've been paying down the principal and hopefully at an accelerated rate.
That's right,
Well, look, if you're happy, if you're prepared to own the property for a very long time, eventually the oversupply will be soaked up, and I suspect everyone will just be fine. It's, you know, my message is really about those people who have taken on too much debt and are relying entirely on the income of the property and relying entirely on interest rates staying low in order to maintain that property ownership. And if they're under any pressure, it doesn't sound like you're under that sort of pressure, so you're going to be okay. And if you're willing to ride through, you know, the thing is, it's much harder to buy and sell and time it right. It's much easier to buy and own and add to the portfolio if property prices do drop. You know, that's a much easier thing to do. The decisions are much easier in that situation. But people who've taken on too much debt and are relying on, you know, on steady or rising income from the property, they're the ones who are going to be in trouble and might be forced out at precisely the wrong time.
Hmm. And also other ones, it's maybe possibly best paying the interest-only loans. That rising property price hasn't happened, so they may... And the equity drops, you know, because of the
Well, it's interesting.
Drops.
It's interesting the bank's responses, you know, they're really restricting how much they're willing to offer and to whom they offer interest only loans and investor loans because they do see lots of risk.
Happened, you know, 5 years ago or 8 years ago when that was allowed, and now, you know, the low doc loans and all those sort of stuff.
Yeah, indeed.
Okay. All right, mate. Good luck with it.
Thanks very much.
Good luck with the decision-making process. But, I mean, in essence, you're saying just be hard-headed about it and imagine some, you know, some scenarios.
So very quickly, we've only got a few minutes left, but, you know, that's where I think there are some dangers and some risks. The other place where I think there's lots of dangers and risks is in the old conventionally described blue-chip companies in Australia, you know, the supermarkets, the banks, BHP and Rio, you know, and Telstra, because those large cap companies, those very big companies, what's happened is that they're very expensive because everyone's chased the higher yield. But at the same time that they've become expensive, they're offering very little growth because the boards of those companies have elected to pay the majority of the earnings out as a dividend. And so where that's the case, there's very little profit being retained for future growth. So if you look at Telstra's earnings, it's no higher than it was 10 years ago. And as a result of that, there's been no income growth. So if you put $100,000 into Telstra back in 2005. Today, it's worth about $105,000. And the income from the property 10 years ago, the income from Telstra 10 years ago was about $5,800. And today, it's about $6,500. So it hasn't even kept up with inflation. So I worry for investors, if interest rates do rise, then that fixed income that's coming from these companies won't look as attractive and future buyers will not be willing to pay the same high prices for those companies. Where I think investors are going to do very well over the next few years is where we've had a crash in these high growth small cap companies and or mid cap companies. So there's businesses like REA Group and Isentia and Healthscope, for example, the owner of 45 private hospitals in Australia. They came out with this just as an example, but they came out with an announcement recently where they said, look, we've had an unusually volatile last quarter to September, particularly the September month. And then they went on to say, if what we saw in September in terms of private hospital admissions, if what we saw there continues for the next 9 months, which is, you know, a big ask, then we won't see any profit growth. We won't see any EBITDA growth. EBITDA stands for earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization. And so the market was expecting 10% growth. They immediately assumed the worst. And then they said, okay, we're going to sell the shares. And the shares fell 27% in 2 days. Now, I can't think of an industry in Australia that has more certain growth ahead of it than healthcare and private hospitals in Australia. Private hospital admissions are growing on average at about 3-4% a year, whereas the population growth is only 1.6% or 1.4% a year. And the two greatest contributors to private hospital admissions in Australia, the two cohorts are the 65 to 74-year-old age group and the plus 85-year-old age group. Now, they also happen to be the fastest growing cohort in the Australian population. Baby boomers were the first generation of people to take up jogging as a pastime and aerobics. So there's going to be a lot of knee replacements and hip replacements.
They're all going to live longer.
And it costs, and think about this, the public system currently has a 9-month waiting list. You know, if you've got a buggered knee or you've got a problem with your hips, you aren't willing to wait 9 months. I think if you look back at quarterly data for hospital admissions, the reality is that it is a little bit volatile. But if you go back 5 years, it's growing strongly. If you go back 20 years, the curve is even steeper and it's going to continue growing strongly. And yet the share prices for these companies have now fallen up to 30%. Mm. So that's where I think it's not in apartments, leveraged apartments. It's not in the big blue chips.
But it's some aspect, well, it's in these mid-caps of the
share market.
The
big institutions were forced to sell because they were underweight the banks and the resource companies, and they believe that's where the growth is going to be. So they've sold these companies down rather aggressively. I'm always asked the question, Phil, you know, Rog, if everyone thinks about quality the way you do, then how can those companies ever be cheap? Well, I've just described a scenario where they've become cheap.
Hmm. Andy's been waiting on a long bit. Sorry, Andy.
Yeah, I was listening with interest, and there seems to be from my point of view at least, there's a few other aspects of investment that probably weren't covered, and that's more the bricks and mortar and
Precisely, what do you mean the bricks and mortar?
The structure of the building itself, from the foundations up, you know, the integrity of it, and...
You mean what the thing, building quality issues, you know, yep, that's a fair question, yep.
And also the ethical investments, as far as that goes. I think one of the other callers may have mentioned that there's a bit more to investing and buying in houses than just the speculation aspect.
Hmm.
I
think that's a completely fair comment too.
Don't want to buy something that's riddled with white ants, and you don't want to buy something that's...
John says, Rog, what are your thoughts on the likely effect, flow-on effect, to the general economy and stock market if the scenario you describe comes to fruition?
That's a great question. There is no correlation over a one-year period between the economic growth rate and stock market performance. There's no relationship whatsoever. Mm. A study that was conducted by a friend of mine showed that and he looked all around the world, and so I think there was something like 300 or 600 data points. In years where the economy grew stronger than average, half the time the stock market did better than average and half the time it did worse than average. And where the economy grew less than average, including recessions, half the time the stock market did better than average and half the time it did worse. But I think it's important to understand how individual industries and businesses are affected by economic performance. So if, for example, the residential construction boom ends, then there's going to be construction in Australia employs about 12% of the workforce in Australia. So there's a large proportion of people who are at risk of losing their jobs. Even if 20% of people lost their jobs in the residential construction industry, you're talking potentially about 2% of the workforce. What impact will that have on consumption, for example? What will the end of the renovation boom and the fitting out of new apartment boom do to the sales of new furniture?
You're seriously suggesting that's what's going to happen?
Well, I can't see the scenario that we've just painted, which is backed up by some statistics. I can't see how there won't be a sudden end to construction development in Australia. When that happens, see, people buy new apartments, they go to Harvey Norman or Nick Scali, and they fit them out with new, they kit it out. Mm. So I've seen this before. I've been around long enough to have seen this before, that those businesses do very well for a period just after the residential construction boom. But then when it ends, they also slow down. And so what happens to those individual businesses and those individual sales trajectories? Well, we've got fairly good precedence in history.
Would you then wait if you were a first home buyer and wanted to get into an apartment because you can't afford, in say Sydney and Melbourne, you can't afford a house. You can't afford a house. So the only thing you can afford is an apartment.
So
would you wait?
Look, I'm the wrong person to ask because I'm a very conservative individual. I waited a long, long time before I bought my first house. I had a 50% deposit before I bought my first property. I just don't like debt.
But young people who are, you know, starting out in life want to get a place. So are you saying you'd be better off
so
at the
advice is the same as what I gave earlier, and that is if you can stomach a doubling of the interest rate or even more, and if you're happy to wear a drop of 25% or 30% in the market price of the property that you've bought, then you've got no problems. If your job's secure, you've got no issue. It's where people have borrowed to buy 1, 2, 3, 4 investment of properties. They've entirely geared them, and they're reliant on the income from those properties to help them pay the mortgage. That's where the problem's going to be.
They're going to be in big trouble, aren't they? Yeah.
And remember, we've got a scenario where I think developers are going to be forced to reduce the prices of the apartments that are coming to market.
Yeah. And just to reiterate that point again, which I think is a profound piece of wisdom, remember, there is no market in new apartment prices. It's just what the developer is selling them for.
Indeed.
It does not mean that that is the market price of the apartment. It just means the developer is selling these apartments at a price where he's getting his money back or as much of his money as he thinks he can get back.
Phil, the way I like to summarise it is price is what you're willing to pay or what people are willing to pay, but value is what it's worth. You know, and your job as an investor is to pay a lower price than what it's actually worth.
Mm. Yes, interesting stuff. We've got plenty of time to discuss it. I wish we had more time tonight, Roger. Terrific stuff.
A pleasure.
It's not all gloom and doom. But
no, indeed. I think there's.
But there's a great. There is. Seriously, it is time to be a little hard-headed about the
indeed.
Property always rises argument at the moment.
Oh, look, it doesn't.
It doesn't.
The fact is
that.
It doesn't.
No, we know that.
Mm.
And
the bright spot is, of course, these mid and small cap companies that have just been decimated in the last few months.
Take some advice anyway. Take some proper advice. Get yourself properly geared and make sure, as Roger says, that you do the numbers and just do the numbers and see where your comfort zone is. And if it's outside it, because this could happen, we're not saying necessarily, it could happen, then you should be thinking very seriously about it. All right, Roger, terrific stuff.
Pleasure.
Good to talk with you.
We'll see you next year.
Yes, exactly. Roger Montgomery, Chief Investment Officer at Montgomery Investment Management.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.